So when we interact with sentient beings, we can approach them in multiple ways. And we often do it according to what is most familiar to us, without even thinking if it is open-minded or fair. And I think this is the beauty in the Four Immeasurables, saying that our immediate reaction to others should be one of kindness, loving kindness, seeing their good qualities, so that whenever we interact with others, our focus is on their good qualities. Of course, we acknowledge the negative ones, but we don't dwell on them. We don't make them the first thing that we see whenever we encounter somebody. But we have an attitude that kind of gives everybody a chance to be known in a fresh way without the projections of our various habitual views and emotional responses. Instead, to just see everybody as somebody caught in samsara who wants happiness and doesn't want suffering. And if we do that, we can find a way to relate to everybody. So let's try to do that now, because it's the ground upon which we generate bodhicitta. And then in that way, really progress to devoting our lives to bringing about the welfare of other living beings. And seeking awakening in order to do that. So I just had an interesting experience, which was the lay behind this motivation here. You know, because we practice, you know, seeing others in beauty, seeing them as just wanting happiness, not suffering. And then sometimes out of left field, something happens and our training in that goes bye-bye. You ever experienced that? So this is why practice means repetition for a really long time and constantly monitoring our mind to see if it's what we want it to be. So my personal example of this, because if you had told me a week ago I would react this way, I would have said no. So As you know, I am all one for religious freedom, you know, and respect amongst religions and no religious persecution and all. I mean, you know my background, you know how I think about that. Okay, so we received an email from some group that wants to have a Zoom panel about religious freedom, and they're looking for people from different religions to participate in it. Okay. Superficially, this looks like, oh, just the kind of thing I'm interested in. What did my mind do? It went, are they going to politicize this? Are we going to get dragged into some political something or another? Because the whole thing of religious rights has become very political now. And, you know, I'm all for religious rights, but I am not at all for pushing one's own views on everybody else. Yeah. Or, yeah, whether we push our views on others on a personal level, like when you're sitting next to them on a long flight, or if they're trying to do that on a governmental level by enacting certain policies that benefit their group but don't take into consideration other groups, or when they want to do that by the courts, by politicizing the courts, okay? So I do not like any of that at all. So it was interesting for me to just read the first little bit about this group asking if we want to participate and watch my mind go, I don't know about this. What is their motivation? Are they sincere? Are they earnest? Or are they gonna, you know, are they really because what's happened in the country recently is that a religious rights has become code in many ways for forcing one's own view on everybody else and refusing to participate in the group, you know, the laws that pertain to everybody. Okay. And, you know, so there's this two different ways of seeing religious freedom nowadays. Yeah. Unfortunately, because I always thought of religious freedom, you know, like I said, if we respect other people and everybody has the right to practice as they wish without government, you know, putting anything on them. And now religious freedom in many places becoming code for pushing one's own view on others, which, you know, if taken to extreme, can become the opposite of religious freedom and become religious persecution if one group dominates the discussion of religious freedom. So it was very interesting, you know, because I like to approach people with an attitude of trust and that, you know, that and to, yes, you have a good motivation. And then if I have to adjust it later, you know, well, I adjust it. But to watch myself, you know, reading just not very much and instantly going into suspicion. Yeah. And I didn't like the fact that my mind did that, instantly went into suspicion. Mm-hmm. I mean, I should give this group a fair chance and look at their what they're writing and ask some questions and so on. Of course, that would take quite a bit of time, which I'm not sure I want to spend my time doing that. Okay. So Just very interesting in the thing. No, I don't want to see sentient beings like that. Yeah, if I have to after some contact with them, that's one thing. But as my immediate interaction, I don't want to approach others that way. Because it's completely, I mean, if you approach others with that kind of suspicion, no way to generate bodhicitta. And bodhicitta, as we've just been through in the last few chapters, is the real heart of everything good that happens in the world. So if there's something in me that is running counter to bodhicitta and impeding me from generating it, I need to do something about that. Okay? So it reminded me to come back to the way I've been training my mind for how many years now? Yeah? And I got to come back, you know, not assume that that is my reaction in all situations, but, can you know, and just say, okay, I do that, so I don't need to emphasize it in my practice, and come back to, no, I need to emphasize it in my practice, because look how easy it is to slip up. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I'm not sure what I'll do with the email. I'll send it to you. Oh, you did the same thing? Really? When you read the email. Do you want to say something about it?
The difference in your training and my training is that when I read it, I did the same thing, and it didn't catch me off guard to think that that's not how I want to greet people. But it's also, I mean, I think what was in my mind was, it wasn't suspicion as much as it was caution. And that these days, getting unsolicited emails from people we don't know requires some investigation. So maybe it wasn't so much, but still, that your reaction was, I don't want to have a mind like this, is something for me to understand and learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, it is true, getting unsolicited emails from people we don't know. Yeah, and we get a lot of them.
There's a lot.
Yeah. There's a lot of them, and it makes you wonder how people found out about us. I mean, we're just some tiny little group, and, you know, we get all these emails. Okay, so that fit in perfectly with what we're studying now in Guide to... engaging the bodhisattva's deeds. So last time we got as far as we did the bodhisattva, the two verses in which we actually receive the engaging bodhisattva precepts. So it's usually said that to get the actual engaging precepts, you have to have actual bodhicitta, actual engaging bodhicitta. So where does that leave all the rest of us? Okay. And why do teachers give the bodhisattva vow so broadly to so many people? Well, they say that if you don't have actual bodhicitta, you get a similitude of the bodhisattva vow, okay? And a similitude's good enough for me. And, you know, and then when you actually generate bodhicitta, it becomes the actual engaging vow. Something else that often comes up regarding the taking the bodhisattva vow is that the pratimoksha precepts, your five lay precepts, monastic precepts, these things last until the end of this life. We take them until the end of this life, and because they generate a precept body in us, and that precept body goes until the end of this life. But the bodhisattva vow and the tantric vow last, they say you take them until full awakening. So what does that mean if when we die and we're reborn? Yeah, do we still have the bodhisattva vow? And are we constantly creating negativity because we don't want to share our toys with our siblings, and, you know, because we're angry at some kid who threw sand at us in the play box, in the sandbox, or threw rocks at us over the fence between houses, are we just creating a lot of negative karma? So it's not, everything's not so clear. They say that, at least to me, that the bodhisattva vow goes with you into your next life. Yeah. And then whenever I ask this question to teachers, their thing is, yes, it goes with you. And then that gives you the tendency, the predisposition, the seed in your mind, to want to take the bodhisattva vow again in your next life. Okay, so it attracts you towards bodhicitta, and then hopefully you retake it in that life. But the issue of creating negativities, it's never been, I've never gotten a satisfactory answer from that kind of thing. Maybe somebody else has asked and found something different. But, why do teachers give it so frequently? And if, first of all, we only get a similitude, and second of all, we're taking it into our next life and don't even know we have it in our next life. Okay. I think the reason, again, is to put seeds in the mind. Yeah. And so you'll see His Holiness in when He gives very large teachings. Yeah, he'll usually do the wishing or aspiring bodhicitta, sometimes also the engaging. But at his public talks in the West, people come who are not Buddhist, who are, they don't even know the word bodhicitta, but he gives the bodhisattva, he gives the aspiring bodhicitta. And he even tells people, not just to visualize the Buddha, but if you belong to another religion, you can visualize the religious figures of that religion. Yeah. So in one way, it seems like completely like opposite, And sometimes he'll even give refuge in Buddhism like this, saying that to take refuge involves keeping ethical precepts and being kind, and essentially what you're doing is devoting yourself to a life of trying to generate love and compassion and ethical conduct, and then again have people visualize not only the Buddha but Jesus and Moses and Mohammed and everybody in there when they take refuge. So my take on all of this is that when he's dealing with a very large crowd, one of his purposes is to plant seeds in living beings' minds, seeds that will ripen in a future life in their actually meeting the Dharma and being able to hear teachings. And then at that time, actually take the various precepts or take refuge or whatever. Okay. And not all the lamas agree that You know, because His Holiness will let people take refuge even if they don't believe in rebirth. And not all the lamas agree with that. Yeah. But I think that there's a difference when you're teaching a crowd of several thousand people, and this may be the only time in thousands and thousands of lifetimes that the person has any contact with the Buddha. Yeah. And so since it's such a rare thing for it to happen in many people's lives, he really wants to plant those seeds in their mind. And the people who come to his talks, you know, they're usually the people who have some respect for ethics and love and compassion. And so in doing this short ceremony in Tibetan, which, you know, they get a translation, but how much, you know, they understand it is, you know, differs, that this is the time to reinforce the good heart that they have now in this lifetime and encourage them to continue that, and then to have the seeds to continue that in future lifetimes. Okay, so I think that is very different than when you're teaching a small group of people who all say that they're Buddhists, yeah, and then you're going to have a different attitude towards how you explain things, how you make some of these precepts available to different people. Okay. And yeah, I mean, when we take the Bodhisattva vow in a large group, His Holiness says, you know, now you have it. He doesn't say, well, you know, maybe 100 people in this group actually took it, and the rest of you have the similitude, and maybe even more than that, were distracted and don't have anything. You know, he doesn't say that, because the idea is to really give people some encouragement and some oomph in their practice, thinking that, you know, they made this aspiration or this determination in the presence of somebody that they highly regard, like His Holiness. Okay. So I was answering a question that none of you asked, but I was anticipating. Because it comes often. Anybody have anything to follow up?
Question about giving back the bodhicitta or the bodhisattva vows. There has been some practitioners who gave back the vow to become an arhat. And do you need to have engaging bodhicitta before you can actually do that? In other words, did you need to have the engaging precepts before you can actually give them back?
Well, you know, if I'm going to return a gift, I have to have the gift to return it. But if people think I took the bodhisattva vow, you know, I mean, the whole thing is people should think before they jump into this, because giving up bodhicitta, and we'll come to that, you know, it comes in the next chapter. It's like you've made a pledge to all sentient beings. You've made a promise that you're going to do something. And then you decide, well, actually, my own benefit is more important, so forget that. I mean, even to talk among ordinary people, is that something that is respectable to do? To promise to do things? And to benefit people in certain ways and help them in certain ways, and then change your mind and decide that you don't want to help them? No, it is even in ordinary society, that is not a cool thing to do. So, you know, giving up bodhicitta. They usually talk about giving up bodhicitta because to give up the vow, you have to give up, you know, any... whatever a connection you had with bodhicitta, whatever regard or aspiration you have had, you have to abandon that, you know, to abandon bodhicitta. That's what's usually talked about. So people need to think more closely before they actually take the bodhicitta. And here I'm talking about it in a smaller group when His Holiness isn't, you know, doing it that way. They need to think about it in the same way that before rushing into initiations, empowerments, and promissory rites, people need to think about what it is and what they're doing. Yeah. So it's something that requires thought and commitment, and it's not just some superficial, emotional, well, today, yes, I feel like benefiting all sentient beings, so I'll say these prayers, and tomorrow I'll change my mind. It's not cool. Yeah. And it creates a great deal of negative karma. Yeah. And it'll come more, so I'll explain it a little bit more later about a few things about this word successively follow the practices, you know, sequentially following them. I'll read this other translation. It can be helpful sometimes to read different translations because one translation may clarify the meaning to you more than the other. So I'm not saying this is the case here, but it's interesting to do that. So here, verse 23 and 24 read, just as the previous Tathagatas generated bodhicitta and continued in the gradual trainings of a bodhisattva, I too shall generate bodhicitta for the welfare of sentient beings and train step by step in the trainings. So that gives you a different feeling than just saying successively. Yeah, so Gyaltsa Jay is saying after you, when the previous Tathagatas has generated bodhicitta, they initially generated the aspiring bodhicitta in front of the Buddhas and bodhisattvas, and then afterwards they took the bodhisattva vow and generated engaging bodhicitta. And after taking the engaging vow, they trained and remained in the gradual bodhisattva trainings. Okay, so the idea behind taking engaged bodhicitta is that you want to train your mind and actually practice. For aspiring bodhicitta, you're aspiring. For engaging, you really want to get involved and do it. Okay, and so here it's saying that when you want to practice it, you practice it, the bodhisattva practices, you do them step by step. Yeah, it doesn't mean that you first master generosity, and while you're practicing generosity, you don't practice ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stabilization, and wisdom. Yeah. It means that you emphasize the one that you're training in as well as practicing the other ones. Okay, so successive practice, it's like people who eat different things. Somebody is going to eat every single Brussels sprout on their plate before they eat any rice, and then they're going to finish the rice before they eat any chili peppers, okay? So they just do one at a time, yeah? That's not how we practice the bodhisattva vow, yeah? You emphasize, if your Brussels sprouts are first, you emphasize them, but you mix some rice and chili peppers in it. Okay, because when you study the perfections, it talks about how to practice each perfection in relationship to all the other ones. So how to integrate them together into your practice. Okay, so Gelsabje continues, likewise, for the temporary and ultimate benefit of sentient beings, either in front of an actual preceptor or a preceptor with the pure bodhisattva vow, or in front of invoked Buddhas and bodhisattvas who we ask for their attention. In other words, in front of an altar and the visualized Buddhas and bodhisattvas. Okay, then we generate the aspiring mind of awakening, and then say, likewise, I shall also train and remain in the gradual trainings upon having generated the engaging mind. So in those two verses, we're doing both aspiring bodhicitta and engaging bodhicitta. Okay? So you repeat them, the verses three times, either after the preceptor or after the, or, you know, in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that you have generated or imagined in front of you. Okay, now the meaning of training gradually. Gelsabje says, practices like the generosity of one's body should not be done with an impure mind. Otherwise, it becomes a fault. It should be done when it does not become a fault and rather becomes a great accumulation of merit. Okay, so what would be a fault in practicing generosity of your body? Okay, so nowadays, generosity of the body has a much expanded meaning than it did in previous centuries, because now you can give an organ without giving the whole body. Okay, so what would impure motivations doing it be? So that you could parade yourself around of, look what a compassionate person I am. I'm giving my kidneys and part of my liver and this and that. Yeah. And, you know, wanting some kind of reputation about that. Yeah. In terms of giving our whole body, like the example of feeding the Buddha in a previous life, feeding his body to the tigress, there you have to have reached a certain level on the path where you would have the ability to control your rebirth. And when you've done that, then you can give your body, and there's no danger to yourself. But when you give your body without having, you know, enough stability in your mind and enough merit and enough training to know that you will have a good rebirth, then if you give your body deliberately, it could harm you and by falling into the lower realms. And in that way, it would harm all the other sentient beings who are counting on you to attain Buddhahood. Okay? So we, at the path of preparation, the peak stage, I think it's the third stage, at that point, you will no longer fall into the lower realms, okay, in your next life. But only at the path of seeing, when you've realized emptiness directly, do you have the power to control where you are reborn, okay? So I would say somewhere on the path of preparation, you have to have that level of confidence to give your life, you know, consciously, deliberately to benefit somebody. Now, we also have situations where people just act spontaneously when they see somebody else in danger. And I'm thinking there of the man who jumped onto the subway tracks in New York to shield, was it a child or somebody who had fallen on the tracks, and he laid right on top of them and the subway went right over them. You know, and this man just did it spontaneously. There was no thought, you know, to do it. And I read an article recently. It was a teenager. Did anybody read that article? I'm forgetting exactly what he did. But I think, I think the driver of a car had had a heart attack or a stroke, and the car was driving erratically. And he tried to stop it and couldn't, but eventually it stopped. Oh, no, it was a car that was on fire. And the driver didn't know it was on fire. So it was driving erratically. He was trying to wave it down to get it to stop. And it was eventually it ran into something and stopped. And this teenage kid ran up to the car, opened the driver's seat, dragged the driver out, and then opened the back seat and took out two kids. And then the whole car exploded in flames. So this kid, you know, afterwards people were going, wow, you're here. And he said, you know, I didn't think about it. I just did it. You know, it's what anybody would do. So, you know, that person's motivation, boy, you can't knock that, even if they didn't have the ability to, you know, to be sure not to get a lower rebirth if they had gotten killed in the process of doing so. Okay. But, you know, generally, this is presupposing that you have some time to think about it, you know. There's the tiger there, and you can think and weigh the options. But of course, for me, if I think and weigh the options, then I always come out thinking about myself first. Whereas, you know, if there's something spontaneous, then in some ways it would really be more authentic than, looking for all the excuses why not to do something. Okay. So some opponents posit as the meaning of sequential training that one trains sequentially in the three moralities. Okay. So first you do the morality of restraint, then the morality of building up virtue, and then the morality of benefiting others. Okay. So that's that whole idea that I just described. First you do one perfection, then you do the next, then and you don't cross over. And Gyaltsev Jay says this is incorrect. Okay, so we should try and integrate our practices. Like when you're doing generosity, to think about it with wisdom, and contemplate what they call the three spheres, seeing the agent, object, and action as dependent and thus empty. And you practice ethical conduct when giving generosity by, you know, only giving things that are appropriate to give to appropriate people at appropriate times. And you practice fortitude by not getting angry if the person doesn't thank you profusely for your amazing, unbelievable generosity. And you practice joyous effort by, you know, joyfully practice generosity. And you practice meditative concentration by making sure your bodhicitta intention is stable when you practice it. Okay? So that's how we should practice. We don't separate out and divorce the different paramitas from each other. Others posit the meaning as having a separate ceremony for the generation of the engaging mind and the engaging vow. This is also incorrect, according to any of the great sages. Okay, so in this vow, we do aspiring and engaging. Okay. So to take the engaging mind after first taking the aspiring mind and then training in the aspiration to practice the perfections is the supreme method that accords with the differences in different persons. It is also suitable to take the two minds sequentially in one ceremony. Okay. So at first it says, you take the engaging mind after first taking the wishing mind. So first you do the wishing mind, then the engaging mind, and then you train in the wish to practice the perfections. Shouldn't you train in the perfections themselves because you just took the engaging mind? I think, you know, maybe here he's really enforcing that we have to have a very strong aspiration to actually engage in the bodhisattva conduct. Yeah. So even after we've taken or generated the aspiring mind and the engaging mind, then to really reinforce the aspiring mind so that we can practice all the paramitas. Yeah, not just saying, well, I took the engaging mind, but, you know, I don't really have it, so I'm just going to practice aspiring for bodhicitta sometime in the future. No, we should actually do something. Okay. Okay, now come the verses of rejoicing by praising the bodhicitta. So that starts... Okay, verse 25. In order to further increase the bodhicitta from now on, those with discernment who have lucidly seized the bodhicitta in this way should highly praise it in the following manner. In other words, you just did something extraordinary and it's going totally against your whole habit in samsara. So you need to really reinforce this so you don't go back to your old ways. So how do you do this? You're going to praise the bodhicitta. Okay. So verse 26 says, today my life has borne fruit. Having well attained this human existence, I've been born in the family of the Buddha and am now one of the Buddha's children. In other words, I'm now a Buddhist, a bodhisattva. Okay? So this verse, I think, is quite really something to think about. Yeah? That today when, you know, you've generated the two bodhicittas, taken the engaging vow, and so that has made one's life meaningful. And so many people, you know, especially at a certain stage in your life, when you're young, you're asking, what's the meaning of my life? You know, before you get all tangled up in following all your attachment and trying to please people and do what other people want you to do with your life and all that stuff. You really, what's the meaning of my life? And here it is. Here it is. You know, I've generated bodhicitta. I want to make my life on this path. I've dedicated my life to do this. And I've lucidly discerned this and lucidly seized the bodhicitta. And so my life is now worthwhile. Now, and my teachers have said, you know, when you can make your life worthwhile like this, then it means that everything your parents went through in having you and raising you has been worthwhile. Yeah? So when you think of what your mom went through giving birth, and they call it labor for a reason, okay? It's the hardest work you've ever done. You know, so you think of what your mom's done, what your dad's done, you know, in terms of giving you this body and then raising us through all of our temper tantrums and brattiness as kids, and all of our acting out and, you know, self-centeredness, it brought something good in the end. Okay? So it's a way of repaying the kindness of our parents. Even if our parents don't see this as repaying kindness, it's made everything they went through worthwhile. Usually, parents think, oh, everything I went through is worthwhile if my kids make a lot of money and if they have a good standing in society and they have a good job and they give me grandchildren. You know, then my life has been worthwhile. And here, you know, having a meaningful life is defined completely differently. Okay? Not only for us knowing we have a meaningful life, but also in terms of repaying the kindness of our parents. Okay? So I've been born in the family of the Buddha, and I am now one of the Buddha's children or one of the Buddha's heirs. Okay? So it's kind of like we've added another family. We have our biological family, and then we have our spiritual family. Okay? In ordinary society, the focus is on the biological family, and that is kind of the core unit in any society across the planet, and even with animals, okay? The turkeys, you know, turkey chicks stick with turkey mom, okay? So, but the biological family, although it is necessary and helpful for society in general, in terms of spiritual practice, the biological family can hold us back. Yeah? Because you get stuck in everything that's happening with your biological family, and your loyalty goes there. Your decisions are made in conjunction with them. Yeah? And your feeling of belonging in the world is in conjunction with your biological family. Now what's happening is we're adding another family, and at the same time as monastics, we're actually switching families, yeah? Who are my parents now? The Buddha, yeah? Who are my siblings? All the other bodhisattvas. And so I belong to that family. So that's the family I'm loyal to. That's the family who I don't want to disgrace. And that comes in the next verse when Shantideva says, thus, whatever actions I do now on must be in accord with the family. Never shall I disgrace or pollute this noble and unsullied family. Okay, here it says race, but it means family. Okay, so, or group, whatever, however you want to do it. So just as ordinary people, you know, you belong to a certain family, but you belong to a clan. You don't want to disgrace it by doing something terrible that brings shame and bad reputation on the people you care about in your family. Okay, so this is taking that same kind of ordinary way that people behave and saying, look, I just promised to benefit all sentient beings and to train my mind in doing that. And that's what makes me part of the Buddha's family. So I did this voluntarily. It wasn't that I was born into it and have no choice. I did it voluntarily, and so now I should act accordingly. I shouldn't act in a selfish, self-centered way, just thinking about myself and my own awakening and my own happiness. Yeah, because if I do that, then people will look and say, you know, what in the world is the Buddha teaching? His disciples are acting all cattywampus. Yeah. And people will lose faith in the Dharma. So, you know, it's again reminding us our actions influence others, you know, and although we are not responsible for how others interpret our actions and emotionally respond to that, we cannot control other beings' responses and their emotions, but we are responsible for our behavior and thinking about how our behavior could influence others in a positive way or in a negative way. So instead of just saying whatever we want, doing whatever we want, yeah, not thinking of how it's going to influence the people around us, or in the case of governmental officials and politicians, how it's going to influence the entire country. You know, realizing that we have some responsibility for our behavior in that way. Okay, so then going to verse 28, just like a blind person discovering a jewel in a heap of rubbish. Okay, so get that visualization. Yeah, let's change it a little bit. That photo of the child with the vulture sitting next to him. Take the visualization of that child finding food and water and somebody that loves them in a pile of rubbish. Yeah? Think of the joy that that child would feel. You know, he's not going to be eaten by the hawk. Yeah. And he's loved and he now has food and clothing, so he will live. Okay. When you're in a situation like that child is, that's almost like a miracle, isn't it? Yeah. So it says we're comparing that with us finding the bodhicitta and generating it in our own hearts. Likewise, by some coincidence, it's not even a coincidence, it's like a miracle. The bodhicitta has been born within me. Now, how can you compare that to the situation of that child? Compare our generating bodhicitta to the situation of that child. Okay? When we generate bodhicitta, I mean, it is like a miracle. When you think of what we have been involved in since beginningless time in samsara, or even if you just think how you lived the first part of your life before you met the Dharma and before you encountered teaching somebody's citta. Yeah? How taking refuge and generating bodhicitta has completely changed your life. Yeah? Totally changed your life. If I look back at my life before I met the Dharma, it's like, you know, I was headed straight for the lower realms. And I would have made a mess of this life, a mess of many other people's lives in the process of my selfishness, and created the karma for myself to wind up in, you know, a lower realm for quite a long time, you know. And you take some kid, like most of us here, who grew up in a Christian society without any Buddhist influence, And how in the world did we meet the Buddha Dharma? And how in the world did we have the fortune to be attracted to it and to want to engage in it and practice it? Yeah. How many other kids that you went to school with through all your years of schooling had that fortune and did that? I had one, actually. Ellen Wallace and I were classmates all through, you know, through school. And it's totally amazing that two of us came out of that community and, you know, got into the Dharma. It's shocking if you knew what the community we grew up in was like. Yeah? So, you know, look, think in your own situation, how you were raised, where your life was flowing towards, you know. And then here, not coincidence, but there was some karma in previous lives that made it seem like a miracle. You met the Dharma and the Bodhicitta in this lifetime. And not just met them, you were attracted to them and wanted to practice. So many people, as we know, meet the Dharma one time, and that's it. Yeah. How many people do we have who come to the Abbey and they don't even make it in the meditation hall? Yeah. So, you know, having a mind that has faith, has interest, is predisposed, again, it's really so uncommon, especially for people who grew up like we did. Yeah. And, you know, there's some of you, there's three of you who grew up in societies where Buddhism existed, but you say, I didn't even know much about it when I was growing up. I didn't have any faith. Yeah. So, you know, how remarkable it is. Okay. So that is a reason why we should respect ourselves and not put ourselves down. Okay. When you look what's happened thus far in our lives, yeah, how can we put ourselves down and tell ourselves that we're stupid, we can't do anything right, we're incompetent? You know, how did you go from how you grew up to now? And I was especially thinking a few years ago when Venerable Tenzin was here. And so it was Venerable Tenzin and you, and who was there, somebody else who grew up under communism? Was it just the three of you? Somehow I thought there was a fourth one. But I can't think of who that would be at one of the retreats. Anyway, when you think of that, you know, people growing up under communism even, and then meeting the Dharma and being attracted to the Dharma. That's really, you know, how in the world did that happen? Yeah. Or growing up under an authoritarian government like you did. How did that happen? You what?
You didn't have an authoritarian government.
No, well, you didn't have an authoritarian government, but you had a lot of rebels who were killing people.
Yes, we had a very long, long conflict, civil conflict with the guerrillas, not to mention the narcos.
Okay, so growing up with the narcos and the guerrillas, okay, not an authoritarian government. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how did you survive that? Well, you left, but, you know.
My father didn't.
Huh?
My father didn't.
Your father didn't.
Many others were killed.
Yeah. Yeah. Many others were killed. Hmm. Yeah, so when we look at it this way, there's no way we can denigrate ourselves. Yeah, it just, Yeah. I mean, we really need to feel overwhelmingly joyful that we've met the bodhicitta and made a commitment to cultivate it in our hearts. So verse 29, and I should add too, because I'm hoping that the people from the Arab countries are still following the teaching and how remarkable it is for them too. They're on, you guys are online. I mean, look at what you've done too. It's just amazing. Okay. So, verse 29, it is the supreme ambrosia that overcomes the sovereignty of death. It is the inexhaustible treasure that eliminates all poverty in the world. Okay, so bodhicitta, how does it overcome the sovereignty of death? Yeah, because motivated by bodhicitta, we realize emptiness. Okay. We've been studying the Pramnavartika and the verse showing the Buddha as a reliable guide, you know. So first, having generated great compassion, he became the teacher, and teacher refers to realizing emptiness. Okay, so that's same thing here. Then you practice more, you get yourself out of samsara, and you help get everybody else out of samsara. And the cessation of samsara is often known as the deathless state. That's what nirvana is called in the Pali tradition, the deathless, the unconditioned. Yeah, it eliminates all poverty. So by practicing generosity, we eliminate physical poverty by practicing the generosity of love, the generosity of fearlessness. We eliminate emotional poverty by practicing the generosity of the Dharma. We eliminate spiritual poverty. It's the supreme medicine that quells the world's disease. What's the world's biggest disease? Self-grasping ignorance. It's not the coronavirus. Yeah? Coronavirus comes and goes. Self-grasping ignorance, unless we do something about it, you know, has been there from beginningless time and will continue. Yeah, coronavirus will also continue if we don't do something about it. Yeah, but I think having ignorance in our mind is a much greater threat to our happiness. Yeah, coronavirus at worst can take your life one lifetime. Ignorance keeps us in samsara without end. Yeah. It is the tree that shelters all beings wandering and tired on the path of conditioned existence. So all these beings, you know, exhausted, totally exhausted by going round and around in samsara, then finding shelter under a tree, you know, with a picnic. And friends, and you know, it's like that in the sense of giving people comfort in their lives. It is the universal bridge that leads to freedom from unhappy states of rebirth. Okay, so you know, in the first chapter, we read about the benefits of bodhicitta and how it enables us to create so much amazing merit. So in that way, it leads us from creating the causes for unhappy, unfortunate states of rebirth. It's like a bridge to take us to good rebirths. It's the dawning moon of the mind that dispels the torment of disturbing conceptions. So the sun is often representing wisdom. It illuminates the mind. The moon represents bodhicitta. It cools the heat of the afflictions. Okay, so here it's cooling the torment of all the disturbing conceptions and all the afflictions. And bodhicitta does that, yeah? Because, you know, when you have affliction running rampant in your mind, if you meditate on bodhicitta, you have to overcome those afflictions, you know, at least temporarily, and then eventually you realize emptiness, you overcome them completely. It is the great sun that finally removes the misty ignorance of the world. So this is your name, Nima, what it is referring to. Okay. It is the quintessential butter from the churning of the milk of Dharma. Okay. So they always say when you churn milk, the cream rises to the top and that's the rich, good stuff. Yeah, so that's how you make butter. So if you churn the Dharma, you know, the rich, good stuff is the bodhicitta that you find. For all those guests traveling on the path of conditioned existence who wish to experience the bounties of happiness, this will satisfy them with joy and actually place them in supreme bliss. So if we can teach the bodhicitta, spread the bodhicitta, you know, all those people traveling on the exhausting, endless path of conditioned existence, samsara, who only wish to experience peace and happiness, yeah, if we can help them to meet the bodhicitta and to generate bodhicitta, this will satisfy them with joy. Yeah. So we should remember this, you know, whenever our mind starts to get depressed or discouraged, you know, I know I'm so depressed, the country's falling apart, everything's so corrupt, you know, I'm so unhappy because they keep making kidney beans and what are the other ones? Garbanzo beans, you know, for lunch and cabbage. And I'm so unhappy and I'm so unhappy, you know. So they're unhappy because of big things, unhappy because of small things, and unhappy about everything in between. Okay? Like the result of the outcome of the investigation into Breonna Taylor's death was, you know, so unhappiness about that too. But if we generate bodhicitta, then we can't hold on to any of that stuff, yeah. Because our mind is filled with joy, our mind is filled with goodness, it's filled with optimism. And when you see what His Holiness went through in his life, yeah, and how he really has such an optimistic view and why he's such a joyful person. Now, why is it? It's bodhicitta. Today, in the presence of all the protectors, the Buddhas are called protectors because through teaching us the Dharma, they protect us from dukkha. So today, in the presence of all the protectors, I invite the world to be guests at a festival of temporary and ultimate delight. May gods, demigods, and all be joyful. So today, in the presence of the protectors, I am going to be the host that invites every single sentient being to a festival of temporary and ultimate delight. How am I doing that? By generating the bodhicitta and working for their benefit and may they be happy. That's, you know, there's one more person who's generating bodhicitta in this planet, because when one being generates bodhicitta, all of us benefit from it, because that person has really promised to work for the benefit of others. Okay? So here, you know, you have the visualization. There's all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you know, at your picnic. There's a huge, huge tree. Yeah. And all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they're kind, they have the special seats. And then you invite everybody to come. Okay? Everybody, every single sentient being. Yeah? Everybody to come. And you're saying to them in their presence, in the presence of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, I'm going to work for your temporary and ultimate benefit. Yeah? So, I mean, wow. That's better, you know, it's a better festival than what people do in non-COVID times when they have a wedding. Okay? And you have a big party and stuff like that. Okay, so may the gods, the asuras or demigods, and everybody else, may they all be joyful. So this last verse is very important, and it leads directly into the next verse in chapter 4, because here we have generated bodhicitta, invited everybody, you know, and said to everybody, we're going to work for your benefit. So, having firmly seized the bodhicitta in this way, conqueror's children must never waver. Always should they exert themselves to never stray from their practice. Yeah, yeah. So we should never give up bodhicitta, because as these virtues go on, as these verses go on, what is emphasized is we've just invited everybody to this huge celebration and promised them temporary and ultimate bliss, and they all come, and then we're going, I don't feel like doing it. It's all a hoax. Yeah, find your own transportation home. You know, it's like, it's doing that. It's cheating people. It's cheating people. So similarly, having generated bodhicitta, we should be very conscientious never to relinquish it. Yeah. For whatever reason, we should never relinquish it, because it's really going back on a promise that we've made to all sentient beings in the presence of the Buddhas. Okay? So people take marriage vows right, left, and center, and they don't honor them. Yeah, some people do. It's really remarkable. Other people, you know, oh, marriage vows, oh, come, come, go, go. I don't feel like being married to you anymore. There's somebody else more interesting, or, you know, I'm fed up with you. You know, so promises. I mean, look at what's even happening right now. Lindsey Graham saying in 2016, I promise you, if there's a Republican president and an opening on the Supreme Court in an election year, that president should not nominate somebody for the Supreme Court position. He said that. A few others said that. Yeah, they're on tape. And Lindsey Graham said, and you can criticize me if I go back on this. And look what's happened. Yeah? Look what's happened. And Mitch McConnell, you know, not letting Merrick Garland's nomination go forward. And then now pushing whoever Trump nominates to go forward. I mean, it's blatant hypocrisy. So I'm not talking politics here. I'm talking hypocrisy. Okay? So if we invite all sentient beings to this festival because we've generated bodhicitta, and then we just say, sorry, you know, oh, that was a nice thing when I said it, but it doesn't apply to the present circumstance now. My self-centeredness is what applies. You know, then we should be ashamed of ourselves. And here it's the good kind of shame, the shame of, I know I can do better. Okay? So these are worldly examples of what we should not do in our spiritual practice. Yeah. And the outrage that we see with the worldly examples helps us understand really why not to do this in our spiritual practice.
I was going to say that that is the type of banquet where even the latecomers get food. So there isn't the excuse about, oh, you came late, so there's no food for you. But actually, there is a never-ending amount of food waiting for everyone, even to those who show up late.
Yeah. And that's actually what bodhicitta is. There's no sense of poverty in bodhicitta. There's just endless, you know, endless love and compassion. Endless doing what you can within the limits of what can be done. It's not promising people that things that you can't deliver on, because we can't control all the conditions. Yeah. But what it's promising is whatever I can do, I will definitely do. Okay. So that's the end of chapter 3. Okay, we have a few minutes for questions. And then next time when we start, I want to go over Gyaltsub Jay's, synopsis of this chapter. Yeah, because it's nice just to kind of review everything. He has a summarizing verse, and then he has a synopsis. So we'll do that next time. We can take a few questions now.
In verse 28, just like a blind man discovering a jewel in a heap of rubbish, likewise, by some coincidence, the mind of enlightenment has been born. Mm-hmm. I see resistance in my mind when I read by some coincidence, which is interesting because it's a beautiful image. And then it's like, well, it's not by some coincidence. I've created the causes for this.
Yeah.
So that jars for me.
But if you're thinking, yes, you created the cause for it, yes, it jars. If you just think like an ordinary person, yeah. I mean, when you have lunch every day, do you think I created the cause for this? When you went to graduate school, did you think I created the cause for this? I created the cause for this. I went to graduate school.
I did the test to get this.
You did the test to get this. Yeah, what does a test prove? Yeah. Really, think about it. Think about what we do to advance up the ladder in worldly society. And how much does it really prove about our integrity as a human being and our kindness and the value of our life? Yeah? And we've all worked very hard in worldly ways. But when you die, is that what the meaning of your life is going to be? Yeah? That you have your diplomas and degrees and certificates of belonging to different professional groups and associations? Yeah? Is that the meaning of your life? When you look at the direction we were going in, it really does seem like, not coincidental to me, but miraculous, even more unthinkable. Okay. So, yeah, you got into graduate school. Yeah, that's wonderful. You got, you know, 15 PhDs. Great. Yeah. Does that mean that your life is going to be meaningful for sentient beings? Does that even mean you're going to have a good life, a good rebirth next time? No, doesn't have any bearing on it. Yeah. I mean, I'm all for education, don't get me wrong. I'm all for education. But, you know, education needs to be used to create good human beings, not people who have good ways of cheating other people. Yeah. How can I cheat under the law? How can I find all the loopholes? Yeah. Yeah, you may be very educated in that. I don't consider that a worthwhile life. Yeah. So this goes into my whole theory about education, which I won't get on that soapbox right now. But, okay, yeah. I don't know. Think about the state of your mind before you met the Dharma. Yeah, were you going in a virtuous direction or a non-virtuous direction? Yeah. I mean, I thought I was a fantastic person before I met the Dharma, that it was only the lying and hypocrisy of all these other people in the military industrial complex that were taking the country down, you know, and that their lies were disgusting, but my lies were done out of compassion. Yeah. And their cheating was horrible. And my cheating wasn't cheating, it was just doing what's advantageous. That's all. Okay. So look sometimes, you know, where your direction was of your life was going before you met the Dharma and what you probably would have done in your life had you not met the Dharma. And then then think about it in terms of purifying, creating merit, you know, advancing on the path. And then it really does seem kind of miraculous. Don't you think? Yeah? I mean, to me, it's like, you know.